Hello, welcome to the Second Society Project. My name is David Schmidt, and I'm here today with a university student who would like to describe and discuss the situation as they are experiencing as students at his particular university. Welcome. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. How are you today?
Great. How about if you tell me a little bit about yourself first, and then we can explore what's going on at your particular institution?
All right. See, I am going on to my fifth year of college here as a math major now. My first 2 years, I was a chemistry major. I hated lab, so I switched to music therapy, actually. And then once COVID hit, I did some recalculating and decided math was the way to go. So, been here a while.
yeah. Right. Well, how did the music therapy work against the COVID? Didn't help, huh?
No, not at all. especially more liberal departments like that completely shut down. So,
yeah. Hey, so you told me that you were having some difficulties, and you have a group of fellow students that wanted to form establish a formal student group, and I think you ran into some obstacles. What can you fill us in about that?
So we decided that my group of friends and I are very conservative, and we're like the only ones on campus at all. So we decided we'd try to get a little group together to give, I hate saying this, but other conservatives a quote unquote safe space that the left likes to use so much. So we decided to do that, and we were trying to get it formalized by the school, but we're running into an issue with trying to find an advisor. All like on-campus clubs and groups need to have a sponsor of some sort. So we sent a few emails out to faculty and staff, and they either didn't respond or they responded with a I don't want to lose my job sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite professors here sent me a full, like, almost essay talking about how he would want to, but he thinks it's best just to kind of keep your, like, head under the covers sort of thing and just wait it out. So it's been a struggle.
Right. How many invitations did you send out?
For faculty?
Right.
Probably close to 10 to 15.
Uh-huh.
And that was just me personally. We've all sent emails, so.
I see. And you had some interaction with these faculty members, and so you thought that they might be reasonable candidates for this?
Yeah, so there is another conservative group on campus, but they've lost a lot of ground in recent years, so they're basically gone. So we reached out to their faculty advisor to, you know, kind of see, didn't get a response. We reached out to, like, the government professors, no response. The only two that did respond to me was a chemistry professor and a faculty member in the athletics department.
Uh-huh. And of course, they, as you indicated, they were uncomfortable with the prospect of being your faculty advisor.
Yeah, the athletics coordinator, I think he's the athletics coordinator officially. He said if the schedule wasn't so busy for athletics, he would have done it, but it was kind of like a maybe later. So,
Yeah. Which turns out to be about just as good as a no.
Yeah, it does.
In truth, yeah. Okay, well, and you have plans to continue this effort to interest a faculty member in your cause?
Yeah, we're going to try again in the fall semester and see if we can get more people on board, get hopefully an advisor. But even then, there's several hoops you have to jump through for the school before it gets approved. One of which is the student government organization here has to vote to allow it.
Oh.
So that will be another struggle.
Right. Do you already know who's on that panel, so to speak?
I do not.
Yeah.
They're very public with certain people. But people like me who kind of stick to their department don't really have that opportunity.
Right.
But based on some of the decisions and things they posted, they lean very much one way. And so I don't have a lot of faith.
Right. It'd be interesting to see what sort of paperwork they have, what sort of form that they have, and what kind of responses you would be required to provide them in this application process.
I know on the school website, they talk about how there has to be a need for the organization, and the dean of students and the student government has to also see that need. So it'll be interesting to see.
Right. Well, since there are no other conservative organizations, one would think that would be just prima facie evidence for the need. I mean, the fact that you want to associate, that you want to be able to, as a group, examine issues and materials that you're learning about in your classes in the light of your political and ideological perspectives.
You would hope so, but there is technically one on campus still. I don't think anyone is even in it anymore, but it is under our listed clubs and organizations. So they might pull there's already one. Why do you need another?
Right. Right. Do you, you know, as we talk about this, it occurs to me, well, and I know that you're meeting off campus as a group, or even let's just say if you meet on campus, it's just informally as people meeting, not with some sort of official sanction from the institution. But so tell the listeners who may not be familiar with inside intestines of an academic institution, what's the reason why you seek formal recognition by the university? What are the benefits?
So we can't do literally anything without being recognized by the university. We are not allowed to fundraise on campus. We're not allowed to do recruitment events on campus. We can't hold events on campus, period. So there's a lot of knowledge that can be expressed. You know how you can like find YouTube videos of people just like debating and things?
Yes.
We can't even do that on campus. Yes.
So you couldn't reserve, for instance, you couldn't reserve a room on campus.
we can reserve a room under one of our names as like an informal gathering, but we can't, as an organization, reserve a room. And organizations take higher priority over individuals.
So, and I assume you couldn't like post it on university, like in a university newspaper or online or something like that.
Right.
An official website, right?
Even on my personal Facebook page, I cannot post anything about it. Because if they were like, saw that someone was trying to start up or hosting events for an organization that has not been recognized by the school, they would shut it down.
Right.
So.
And groups, that are given official recognition, I presume that they're able to access a certain amount of distribution of funds from the universities, let's say to have speakers or events, something like that?
Right. Every beginning of the semester, we have to do this allocations meeting where we go into a board of like 7 or 8 students, I think, and we have to discuss what we need the funds for, what we would do with the funds, how much we think we need.
Right. And I suppose you have explored what, the full list of organizations that the university recognizes.
Right. As president of another organization, I've had to look into and see what all we can collaborate with on certain things. So I've seen the list.
Uh-huh. I mean, it must be publicized somewhere, right? On a website or?
It's on the main school website.
Right. And do you notice, are there sort of symmetrical groups, parallel groups of a different political persuasion that are recognized that you could maybe make reference to as you try to build your case for recognition?
Most definitely. The issue is there's no specific like Democrat group or liberal group. They hide under things like Gay Straight Alliance or LGBT or BLM or things like that.
I see. And I don't suppose, I guess this is half facetious, but maybe not. How about if one applied as a heterosexual student group?
I can almost guarantee that would also get shut down.
Sure.
Just because, I mean, we all see it. Anyone listening to this has some vague idea. The straight sexuality is nothing now. If you identify as that, you're looked down upon by members of the left.
Right.
You're seen as non-inclusive now because you are limiting yourself, which that's another big hoop you have to get through. You have to prove that you are not discriminating against anyone.
Well, I mean, let's say that you didn't have any prohibitions against somebody who was identifying themselves as some other type of sexual persuasion. If you didn't prohibit them, it would seem to me that this would be the beginning of actionable legal challenge. It sounds like a tort lawyer would be just the right thing in this kind of situation. And, you know, there are these organizations, maybe you've not heard of this, you might check into it, something called FIRE, F-I-R-E. you might check into that. Are there any other, maybe let's say national organizations who you could interact with and maybe garner some support in your local cause?
So the organization that we are trying to become a chapter of has their own process for dealing with this sort of thing. The
discrimination.
Issue, yeah, discrimination or, I mean, that's the biggest thing is if the school refuses to allow us, they can step in. The part that I'm waiting until we get to that step though. Because right now it's just we can't find an advisor. You can't really build a case around that. It's more of a, you know, he said, she said thing. Someone could genuinely be busy and we just don't know because there's not that communication there. So after we find an advisor and apply for, can't think of the word right now, but to be recognized by the school, if then we get shut down, I would take the next step.
What would happen if you sent a blanket invitation to every faculty member in the university? Of course, you know, that would go to just about everybody who is opposed to your persuasions. You would be defining not just a sample, but a whole universe of faculty members who, I'm going to guess, are going to refuse involvement with your group. Now that is, you know, that's one more bit of evidence to document you know, the case is constructed for protecting yourself legally and seeking redress. I'm not advising, you know, that you folks pursue a campaign of lawfare, but at some point, if you're unsuccessful, it will be nice to have the recorded history of all your attempts. And this might extend beyond a given semester or a given year. This might have to be a project for the, let's say, the generations of your group to take up in turn as members graduate and as members matriculate. And again, to have that file, you know, each thing that you attempt to make sure you document it well and make it sort of evidence ready for an attorney.
Yeah, the issue is going to be, since we're not allowed to hold recruitment events, it's basically just one-on-one, hey, would you be interested in this? And we can't hold like a mass gathering.
Right.
So it's sticking to very close to people we know, which unfortunately all of us are in our junior, senior years.
Yeah.
So a lot of us are going to be graduating off soon. I graduate next spring. Half the group graduates next spring, actually. So it'll be hard keeping the fire alive after a couple
years. Well,
you
know, the other advantage, forgive me, we can edit this out. Let's go back to where, why don't you repeat your last sentence so that I can clip that out, okay?
Okay. So the issue.
You were telling me that it's a disadvantage that people are going to be graduating.
Right. Most of us are in our last years of college. The majority of us graduate next spring. and then the few remaining will graduate the spring following. So it's hard to keep that going.
Right, but, you know, just as a note of encouragement, the fact that you can't have mass gatherings, you can't set up tables on recruitment day, etc., this also can work in your favor, because essentially your members have to really assume the sort of behavior, the strategies, the attitudes of like an evangelist, like a religious evangelist, and because you're busy and you can't devote separate time of any great amount to this, that means at every opportunity in the cafeteria, in a local coffee shop, at the library, you know, all the places on the street, people need to be striking up conversations with people as a first step, just to get to know them, as a next step of seeing if there's common interest, as a third step, inviting them to participate in an informal association of students. You see what I mean? And then the fact that you're sort of under the gun because time is ticking away, this can add that element of urgency that each person can, if they embrace that, it could really turn around quickly. And, you know, a year is plenty of time to actually kindle a fire.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is we're all of the older ones, like me and the other seniors, are now working a ton, trying to, you know, pay rent, pay bills. A lot of us are in other organizations too. Like I mentioned, I'm president of another organization. So it's just balancing. And then another problem, which this is one of the biggest problems I have with my generation. Some of us are just lazy, and aren't willing to put effort into this more than they have to. So once the most passionate of us go our separate ways, I think everything just kind of dwindles out.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's always, you know, you always have, in any organization, you have a distribution of people with different motivations, levels of motivation. And in some ways that, I mean, it's just a fact of how biology works and psychology works. So, and there's actually, in a way, there's kind of advantages to having, organizations of humans that work that way. They kind of fulfill different roles. And, I guess, you know, the other thing is to, that I would advise you, having, you know, done these kind of things myself, to always think of it in terms of challenges and opportunities as opposed to problems, you know. It's kind of a neuro-linguistic trick that you can play on your own brain. You know, if you think of it as, you know, waking up in the morning and saying, okay, every, you know, no person I meet today will be, will that meeting be an accident? And how can I see if there's an opportunity there for building our organization? And then also with your group, I presume that you're in communication with them as a group leader, you know, is maybe, and it, again, it falls to you, right? Is to develop little motivational tidbits that you can send out and say, you know, look, let's remember why we're doing this. You know, we're not doing this because of what it you know, of the benefit that accrues to us personally, but we're in this because we're trying to save civilization on the largest scale. And I mean that in a real way. I don't mean that facetiously. We are in trouble, and by trying to save civilization, by trying to do the big thing, you actually wind up doing an awful lot to provide for yourself, your friends, your family, and then as you folks get married and have families yourselves, you're doing a lot to build the kind of world where you and your close ones are benefiting. So it's kind of neat the way it works.
Right. That's one of the things I've been trying with my other organization, actually. In my president report every week, I've been giving like a little inspirational quote more so, just to remind everyone why we're together. Because especially in that group, we're all from different backgrounds. We all have different political ideals, different morals, you know, very diverse group. And so it's like that moment of uniting why we are in this specific organization.
Right. You know, you might, that might be kind of a fun evening for your group, to go out to a pizza parlor somewhere, or maybe to somebody's house and or apartment, and, you know, just have a meal, talk, do whatever you folks like to do as a relaxation. And then say, hey, look, let's sit down and, you know, on a just on some newsprint or something, you know, and with a big magic marker. Let's work out what our real goal is. What are we trying to achieve, you know, as a group? What is it we're trying to preserve or advance or bring into being that isn't there already? And then this kind of engages people's imagination. It gives them a sense of ownership and all those things that, you know, people in organizational studies talk about all the time, right? So.
Yeah, it'll definitely be interesting. There's a lot of fire against us just because we have this political agenda.
But that's great, by the way. That's great. You know, fire against you is a wonderful thing to have. You know, just like they say, there's no such thing as bad publicity. You know, there's having some opposition is really, really good for an organization.
Yeah, I mean, the fear is every year, like when I first came into college, there were a lot more conservatives than I originally anticipated. And each year that number dwindles down and down and down. So what I'm thinking about doing in the future is I'm going to be around this area for a while. We've talked about that with my business ideas.
Yes.
So what I'm thinking of is eventually investing in a house or a building of some sort to hold meetings, just for like-minded people to come and go as they please, build up a library of sorts too, something like that, like I hate using this term, but a safe space for conservatives.
Well, let me give you some thoughts there. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. That is perfectly serendipitous. I was going to suggest that many universities have surrounding them something called houses of study. And for instance, I know that there are like Catholic orders or groups that have these houses of study, and my guess is they exist too for Protestants and Jewish groups, so the idea is that students can opt to live in these almost like independent, they're like independent dormitories. The other thing is houses of study also have their own classes. So it requires some more commitment from the student in that they have an additional class, right, that they go to, class or classes. And I know that in some instances the university will recognize those classes for credit. Now, in this case, of course, that would be a long shot. However, you know, we have to remember how the left thinks, and then sometimes it's good to look at how they think and operate, and where possible, without compromising your values or your virtues or your morals on things, to learn from them, because they are they're very skilled at culture creation and culture change. And that's what your goal is. You're building a competing culture, and so when you encounter, let's say you do succeed, 15 years from now there is a house of study, and called by some kind of name. This house of study has developed to the point where you have some really fine curricular offerings, and you petition the university for the recognition of credits, you know, in a student's formal record. Well, okay, so let's say it's rejected. Fine, don't. Fear the rejection. Don't fear the loss. The left has always known how to do lots of things, and when those things are obstructed or they fail, they then take and use that to their advantage. They build a cause for the recognition of moral superiority. In some cases, they do it using the tactic of victimization. And that can be done without assuming some kind of degraded position or something. In other words, you simply say, look, we're trying to do this, and we've been wronged. And again, you know, you look for legal assistance in achieving what should be your right. And you document all these things. You know, in other words, people in your group become historians. You keep records of email conversations, letters, when things were filed. It all goes into a binder, and it becomes a case study. And eventually this can all then be used when you are trying to argue your grievance at some level of the process of adjudication, whether that's intra-institutionally or whether you have to bring in outside juridical review of your situation. So I would say embrace all that and have to do it. You know, get out there, do it. Do something.
Right. It'll be an interesting and very rocky road.
Yes. And that's the fun part.
maybe.
Right?
We'll see.
You see what I'm trying to impress on this conversation is that our normal tendencies, which are natural for all of us, right, of avoidance of conflict, those things have to not only be overcome, they have to be inverted. You have to get to the point where you're not trying to cause trouble and you're not trying to be obtuse just confrontational for the sake of being confrontational. No, you're trying to do what everybody else seems to be able to do with complete freedom, right? And you're just trying to live your life, and you're also willing to defend it. And as you learn about the process of defense, whether it's through in institutional mechanisms or, like I say, legal mechanisms, then you start to realize, wow, being a good historian is important, you know, record keeping, and then narrating all those historical records so that somebody else who comes by next year and is going to maybe schlep all that stuff to an attorney, there will be a narration in there. It won't just be a bunch of notes and disconnected emails, you know, that you'll put a concluding summary to what happened and where it stands.
Right. I think the biggest issue for us is going to be a lot of conservatives are very conservative when it comes to those kinds of things.
Their big problem is that they're conservatives, yeah.
Yeah, we're not willing to go out and, you know, outside of the little comfort bubble. You know, yeah. We get I forget if it was, I think it was Ben Shapiro who said, conservatives, when they go into the education field, if they get rejected, they're like, fine, I will go be a businessman. You know, it's that sort of thing. We get rejected and we go, okay, we're going into our own little bubble now.
Which just results in our having abdicated a whole sector of society to our ideological opponents.
More than just...
Yeah.
Especially now, it's become everything, even the military now.
Yeah. Right. Right. I mean, I know when I was younger, the problem was it wasn't quite as developed as it is now in terms of conservative abdication. But back then, you know, established conservatives, those who were older than us, you know, would say, "Oh, why do you want to do that?" I mean, Why would anyone be a paleontologist, you know? What the hell is that? I mean, go to work, make some money, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and there, of course, there's value in engaging in enterprise and business, you know, but we also needed to have people in the arts, and people in academia doing even esoteric type studies. Just having them present there is important. And they add something and they take away something as well from these different disciplines. So, and you know, you could think of fields where it's very relevant, like history, philosophy and law. You know, the left did a very good job of capturing law schools, and that has a powerful effect, you know. So you wind up with, you know, a generation or two later, they've packed the courts with liberal judges. And, you know, it used to be that medicine and engineering were off limits. You know, leftists just didn't go into them. Now they've captured medicine. You can see that the whole problem with the COVID crisis was, from my perspective, I see it as one of, you know, leftist conquest of, academic and then, practicing medicine.
Most definitely. It was just an elaborate attempt at government takeover. You know, shut down everything, wear a mask. Now the big thing is get vaccinated. We're not going to tell you why you should get vaccinated, but just do it because we said so.
Right. Can you tell me, I mean, you identify as conservatives, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you think there's any other attributes that make you onerous to these powers that be at the university?
Can you rephrase that question?
Yeah, well, what do you think it is that they really dislike about you? Do you think it's that you're conservatives, that you have an R after your name, or do you think that those are just codes and symbols for something deeper that they really dislike about you?
So I think it's a good mix of both. Yes, we have that R after our name, which is looked down upon in modern society, just genuinely or generally everywhere, because the left has managed to say, oh, you're Republican, you're conservative, well, you're fascist, you're a bigot, you're homophobic, you're all these adjectives that come after it. So carrying the conservative adjective comes with this laundry list of other things that you're not, but the two have become attached.
Right.
So I think it is a fear of if we allow this group on campus, they're going to cause trouble. Not because of who we are, but because of what we stand for.
And by trouble, what do you think they mean?
With other students, mostly, especially some of the students like that I know, even the ones I know personally, you know, you carry that with you. Immediately, they're not your friend anymore. They want nothing to do with you. They'll fire back at you hard. They let their emotions get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of the closest friends I've had, as soon as I mention anything or politics gets involved at all, that was it.
Right.
So, especially in my other organization, I have to be extremely careful with what I say because it is such a diverse group. And that was for some people that mentioning you have a different political idea just severs the ties there.
Right. I've been reading a book. And you asked me whether I thought it was worthwhile. I haven't read it completely. I'm about three quarters of the way through it, and I think I can recommend it based on what I've seen. It's an older book. Let's see. I think it's 2017. Yes, 2017. So this would have been written in during that first Trump election, right? And it's called No Campus for White Men, by the author Scott Greer. And it has a foreword by Milo Yiannopoulos, which I guess most people have heard of by now. So it looks like the subtitle is The Transformation of Higher Education into Hateful Indoctrination. And it seems as though, indeed, that is precisely what happened. I'm kind of enjoying reading this also to just track that arc from something that would have been being written in 2015, 2016, I guess, with a publication date in 2017. And seeing how things have actually developed and how much they've already advanced, or maybe I'd rather say how much they've declined. But still, I think it's a very good book because it sketches out for a student or somebody interested in this topic. It's kind of a handbook for what to expect, and of course you can just say a lot more. And what's the advantage of that? I mean, we all kind of you read a book like this and you say yeah I know. But what it does is it gives you a way of systematizing your own narrative, your 3-minute elevator speech. It gives you terminology. I like to approach a book like this with, underlining or highlighting keywords. And then I put those in my quiver, so that I'm better able to describe things. This is really, it is a part of education. It's just giving the mind the ability to articulate what it perceives pre-verbally, And in many cases, this is what conservatives have been absolutely horrendous at doing. The left, I mean, they have people who are in the arts, in literature. They like the whole thing of storytelling. Maybe they take classes in lots of psychology. And so they have a whole vocabulary, and that is power. Words are power. We need to embrace that level of diction and linguistics and verbosity, if you will. We need to learn how to communicate, to converse, and to persuade. All of these things, oftentimes conservatives run away from, and just about everything conservatives have been doing has been wrong. And so we need to turn all those things around. When I was teaching college, one of the things that I always said on the first day of class is get yourself a dictionary. Get yourself a dictionary, use it. And I would tell the class, it was true. I keep a dictionary in every room of my house. I kept one at my desk at work. And I even kept a dictionary in the back seat of my pickup truck. And that's a fact, So that if I was out at a coffee shop or something and I had an opportunity to sit for a while and read and write, I would make sure I'd grab that dictionary and take it in with me. And I know you can use your cell phone, but having a paper dictionary, I think there's just something immensely sensual about that whole process. And the one I like is American Heritage Dictionary. It's excellent when it comes to etymology or the roots of words. So, okay, that's the end of my spiel on dictionaries. But it's a tool of power. That's what I'm saying. It's a tool of power. And, you know, another book that I think that your group should add to your quiver, it's a book from one of the arch leftists of all time, Saul Alinsky, and it's I think you're going to anticipate what I say. It's the book Rules for Radicals. Absorb it. Learn what what kind of weapons have been formed against you.
Definitely. I think the biggest issue, like, especially our generation faces, is connecting with others,
mm-hmm.
like other groups. Because I can guarantee we are not the only group that has this view. I think it was your podcast on human lattices, the whole spider web effect, you know?
Yeah.
It's these small groups that organize, and then they need to communicate with other groups.
Yes.
It's just figuring out how to do that. Social media.
Those chemistry courses came in handy.
Oh, yeah.
See the transferable knowledge of lattices for you. Yeah.
But with social media and everything, it makes it easier and harder to communicate with other groups.
Right.
Easier because you can just literally just send a message to anyone, but also harder because we get into big tech then, and then
they're monitoring you. They're surveilling you, and then I think it also maybe makes it so that individuals say, well, I am connected. I'm connected through this cell phone, through which I do everything else, including maps and where to eat my next Subway sandwich.
Right.
So there's a kind of cheapening of human interaction by a kind of superficial interaction that you get from just having your Facebook on your cell phone.
Yeah, it definitely takes away from like the social aspect. One of the things I've seen take generations prior to me, like less so my parents, but like my grandma, how mm-hmm. she communicates with people is very face to face. She enjoys phone calls. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very connected. Whereas my generation is here, let me just send a snap real quick on Snapchat.
I see.
And so it's definitely breaking down our social skills, I feel.
Yeah.
Even at dinners with other people, we pull out our phones as soon as we order and just play on that. We don't actually communicate.
Well, you know, that like we had that dinner that you invited me to, which was lovely, by the way. I enjoyed meeting all of you. And I look forward to doing that again. But, you know, that seems to me like something that you can do that flies under the radar of their prohibitions about organizing. I mean, if you know Sam and Katie and Larry and Donnie and Melinda, there's nothing wrong. I mean, you don't have to say this is the XYZ conservative organization, and we're going to have a meeting at 20 official meeting. No, you simply say, hey, Donnie and Melinda and Mary and Tom, how about if we meet at such and such pizza shop, you know, again on Friday, and then just kind of establish it as a Friday meeting once a month or something, you know, so, you know, go around all the dams that they build in your flow, right?
Right. It's a lot of, not secretive per se, but secretive.
Yeah.
But what can you do?
Well, it's not using all their official labels and things. You know, there's a movie you ought to watch. Maybe you have seen it. It's a Humphrey Bogart movie. It's a Treasure of Sierra Madre. And Humphrey Bogart was this kind of well-known. He played in Casablanca and other movies. Anyway, he's up in these mountains in Mexico, and he's surrounded by a band of criminals, you know, and he's pinned behind a rock, and they're shooting at him. And one of this mob steps forward and says to, calls out to him. He says, surrender, essentially surrender. We're the police and we want to arrest you. So put down your gun and come out and we won't hurt you. Well, of course, everybody's after this treasure, right? So everybody's kind of a crook here. It's just a classic line, you know, where Humphrey Bogart says, you know, police, show me your badges. And the leader of this gang says, badges? Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. We don't need no stinking badges. So anyway, we don't need no stinking badges. In other words, you don't need all of their official rubber stamps and approval and stuff. Just be human beings who are exercising your First Amendment rights to speech and assembly and organization and association. And, you know, you're allowed to invite somebody to have pizza, right? So
right. We'll see how much longer that lasts, though. I don't feel like First Amendment is going to be around forever like it should.
Well, you see, there's another thing, you know, to fight for. And, you know, that's something your group can do, too, is have an evening of familiarizing yourself with the Constitution. I mean, my gosh, we could join a fraternity and have, you know, drink beer and do drugs and have sex. So, I mean, and you want to talk about the Constitution? Well, yeah, it's exciting, you know. I mean, because look, it is your tool for defending yourself.
Definitely. I know the organization we're in, when we signed up to be a chapter, sent us a bunch of supplies. So we have at least 100 little Constitution booklets. So everyone should have one by now.
Well, and you know, that's another thing is, you know, hand those out at your next pizza party. Just get rid of all of them you can. Put them out to your friend and give each person who comes, right, in your group, give them all 20, right, or whatever, 10. And then say, look, by the time we have this next meeting, I want, you know, we want to have all of these constitutions gone. Give them to anybody. Give them away. You know, if you're talking with a clerk at the bookstore, you know, and you think they're not just going to throw it in the trash, or maybe if you think they will, just give them one. Get rid of those booklets. Get rid of them.
That is a smart idea because it's taking up a large box in my closet right now.
Yeah, you don't
need all sorts of them.
Yeah, get rid of them. And you know, most of it will be like seed falling on rocky ground. You know, it won't take, or if it takes, it'll be thin soil and it'll grow just a little bit. This is going to sound like a scripture passage, isn't it? But you know, same process is that you scatter, and some places it takes hold, and that's what you're looking for anyway.
Definitely.
I know that you took a trip to the big city and you went to some bookstores. Tell us a little bit about that and how that fits into your overall strategy.
Well, as in, or the popular saying is knowledge is power, right?
Right.
So every little bit we can absorb from these books, which I actually reached out to you and got a list of all the ones you recommended. And we, a buddy of mine, and I went and we picked up some from the list and a few others that weren't off of it or on it. So it's a lot of like what intrigued us was how to influence people, how to speak better, how to act better. Cause a lot of that, I think that's impressive to a lot of people. So like one of the big things with, Barack Obama when he was president was the man could speak very well. And that's why he drew a lot of popularity. Look at some of the greatest, not leaders of all time. They knew how to talk. They knew how to act in public. They knew, you know, so that's something we're definitely focusing on.
I know, you know, a lot of people, I hear a lot of people say that they thought that Barack Obama was a great speaker. I can't, you know, I mean, he was pleasant. I mean, kind of like maybe you'd hear Toastmasters or something. But I never found that that anything he said really connected, as far as I could see, at a deep philosophical level. He was shallow, if you ask me. Now, you know, a speech that by another Democrat that I thought was powerful, and people can get it online, both in written form and also listen to a recording of it, is a speech by John F. Kennedy, and it's oftentimes referred to as his Solon the Athenian speech. Solon, S-O-L-O-N, the Athenian. So I'd recommend that whoever's listening to this, look that up if you're unfamiliar with it. And I think you're going to find something very surprising in there. So I'll just leave it at that as a teaser. But I agree with you completely that these arts of rhetoric, Aristotle wrote a whole book on rhetoric, and it's something that we've lost, and it is so crucial to rediscover these things. And regarding the paper books and other sorts of physical media, there is very much an active war to get rid of books. You know, if something is, and people say, oh, well, you can get that online. You can just look it up online. Well, sorry about my mocking there. But, you know, the thing is that stuff online can be altered. It can be altered, manipulated, and it also can be very easily simply disappeared. It can be airbrushed out of existence. And, you know, I think one of the greatest things that our generation could commit itself to is creating libraries, even in their home, libraries. And of course you want to have an eye to some very practical things, but also get a hold of those works that would be likely to that the powers that be would want to erase from the human archive, the human library, and so become a repository. So I think it's a worthwhile endeavor for people. You know, not as students, you don't really have a lot of money, but as you start working, you know, to visit some rare bookstores. If you go to a large city in travel or for business, a lot of the big ones like Chicago, New York, San Francisco, et cetera, Pittsburgh, you're going to find in university times old bookstores and see if you can't purchase some really good old book. You know, commit yourself to it. I mean, we have to become sort of like the monks who preserved Western civilization during some really barbaric times. We have to catalog these things, protect them, preserve them. We need to be the caretakers of these physical recordations of human activity, wisdom, history, etc.
Right, especially now, because a lot of book purchasing is done through big companies like Amazon.
Right.
And you're really starting to see a crackdown on that. There was a book I was looking for called The American Covenant by Marshall Foster.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's a history book, but in a more conservative light. So there's a lot of references to, you know, God and religion in there too. But you look on Amazon for it, you're looking at paying upwards of at least, I think the cheapest I saw was $400.
Yeah.
And yeah. If you go to the actual website that the book is public, like the actual publisher website, is $28.
Right.
So they're stopping us from buying those books. I forget which senator it was, but he completely lost a book deal after January 6th. Was it Tom Cotton, maybe?
Could well be.
There was that, and then oh, I had another point. Oh, like high schools now, or public schooling, Animal Farm was a big book that they used to teach.
Yes.
And now they've completely outlawed it. Same thing with To Kill a Mockingbird. You're seeing school districts across the nation say, we can't teach that. That's racist.
Oh, my God. You know what's ironic about that is To Kill a Mockingbird inspired armies, generations of liberal lefty lawyers. And you see, in a way, they are eating their own when they do that sort of thing.
Definitely. It's just now it has become a you can't have anything offensive in your book, period. So even like Huckleberry Finn, that's being canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of funny because all these things that the left has decided is cancel worthy is more racist than if they had left it alone.
Right.
Like if you look at, we'll take Aunt Jemima or Uncle Ben, like on the food items, they're canceling all these African American black figures, but they're leaving all the white ones. Like, in that in of itself is racist, but I guess they don't see that.
Yes, they're following an odd type of, I call it a syllogism of association. You know, things are, you know, so premise one is X is, A is associated with B. Premise two is B is associated with A. Therefore, A is associated with C, and therefore A is bad. Well, you know, it's it leads you into self-destruction. And actually, that's kind of a, for our cause, it's probably one of the hopeful mechanisms that's in place whereby nature corrects itself. We just want to help nature correct itself a little bit faster.
It's full on Marxism is what they're doing.
Yeah.
Find every excuse to divide us and claim it's for equality.
Yeah. You know, they and I was having this conversation with another fellow, someone a little older than I am, and we were agreed that, you know, it's very good to analyze these problems. And I remember, this would have been even in the 90s, talking with fellow conservatives, and they had not yet fully analyzed what was going wrong. There was conservative analysis, you know, Bill Buckley, but we now know that, like, William F. Buckley was, I mean, he was a CIA asset, and he was kind of guiding conservatism in a particular direction, and one suspects almost to make it ineffective. But we were really hungry for good analysis. We didn't have it even in the 90s. And it came about, and there are all places where it exists, and it developed and it matured, and it's reaching a stage of maturation where people know about cultural Marxism. They know about the blueprint in The Authoritarian Personality by Theodore Adorno. And I recommend people check that out at chapter 23 if they want a real eye-opener about the war on particularly Europeans, white Europeans. Another sort of bracing book would be Jonas Salk's book, The Survival of the Wisest. Jonas Salk was the researcher who came up with the polio vaccine. Check out Survival of the Wisest if you want to be, you know, brought up to date about just how serious some of these plans really are. And, you know, people now know about Event 201, you know, that preceded COVID. And they know about the anthrax attack and the parallels between COVID and the anthrax attack that was manufactured after 9/11. And then other works exist that can kind of bring people into a state of realization regarding what's going on. It's Zbigniew Brzezinski's America in the Technotronic Age. That's a good one to check out. And, you know, a book that I'm reading right now is Carol Quigley's Anglo-American Establishment. You'll see that really there are, in fact, secret societies. They were set up very deliberately by Cecil Rhodes, the Rothschilds, the Milner groups. And, you know, when they came from Britain to the United States, they took the form of things like the CFR, the Council of Foreign Relations. And these things have powerful effects. Presidents and members of cabinet are drawn from this organization, the Council of Foreign Relations. So it's really good to put your thinking cap on and learn about the things that go on behind the scenes and not get hung up with these accusations about conspiracy theories, of course. I mean, of course, history is nothing but one big conspiracy of people trying to do stuff, you know. People, and it, you know, if you're an aristocrat of a prior century, or if today you're like a techno tyrant from Silicon Valley and banking tyrants, of course you congregate together. I mean, why wouldn't you? And you're going to try and shape and move things in directions that are self-protective. And so we have to be self-protective too. We have to be like vigilant birds. Look at the robins out in your lawn in the morning. If you go out at 5:30 in the morning or 6 in the morning and watch the robins in your lawn, you know, that one of them will be looking around looking for hawks or looking for cats, you know, while the others are pecking away at the dirt. So we have to learn how to be vigilant, and we have to acquire the filters that are necessary to recognize, to do the pattern extraction from this flow of information that's bombarding us.
See, I don't know. There's a lot that's just kind of anti-us, I feel, in modern days, you know? Like, it's like there was this big conspiracy theory, I would say during Vietnam, to kill out the conservative movement. Because that's when all of this started happening. JFK was probably the last conservative Democrat. And then the rest have just progressively gone further and further one way. So I think if we take a look at history, there's a lot that's just kind of towards
even the Republicans are, you know, sort of classic socialists now.
That is, yeah. There's definitely something going on that's trying to move us towards, I would say, like a one nation world, like one government.
One world government, yes.
Yeah.
I remember I had a professor in college. He said, they'll never make a one world government. Well, guess what? Sorry, prof. I live to see it almost here. So if it isn't already here, actually. Yeah, and so, you know, our response to that, and I think this is why I'm so excited about what you folks are doing, is that you are, you know, while you learn about things on the global scale and the national scale, you're also acting on the local scale, and you're thinking about ways of becoming financially independent, and of course they're going to go after that too, and that's going to require a response. But at least we're moving in the direction of trying to figure out how we're going to feed ourselves, quite literally how we're going to, you know, grow and our food and raise the animals. As you probably saw, Bill Gates is now the biggest owner of farmland in the United States. So it's not unreasonable to say, that's a kind of a curious investment for a computer guy. So, there we go. I mean, it's kind of obvious. We need to be vigilant birds, you know.
Definitely need to keep fighting for what's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is going to be, I mean, it's going to be for you, your generation, right? And it's kind of time for, you know, your generation to also be thinking about the next generation, right? And, you know, one of the big things maybe we can pick up on our next show as we kind of close this out will be that your generation is really going to have to commit itself to reproduction and having families, raising good, healthy, secure families. families, and because we win this war with babies. And babies and ideas, but especially babies. Okay. Maybe, do you have any last thoughts that you want to add? Because we've gone on now about an hour and 20 minutes. So how about if we summarize this? What do you want to leave us with until we meet again?
Keep being free thinking. Keep doing what you believe is right. Follow your religion. And don't bow down to tyrants.
Ah, great, great. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I'll have this polished up and posted, and I hope we can do this again. I think there's so much that we can talk about. We have only begun to scratch the surface.
Yes, sir. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, okay. We'll talk to you soon.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye.